Okay, so we meet again once a week. Next week is once a week too, because I think we have class on Monday and not on Wednesday. It's really freaky for me. I hate teaching once a week classes because people forget before the next week starts. So that's why, to stop that, I keep nagging you. And I'm sure you've already blocked my emails, but it's okay. I don't care. I will still keep emailing you. So we're going to start again with today's session. And to kind of set up today's start of the class test, I'm going to pull a couple of slides out of the lecture notes, because you need this to kind of deal with today's test. When you sit down to value a business, you have to make a choice. And let me explain what I mean by that. When I think about companies, I think about a financial balance sheet. And for those of you who are in my corporate finance class, that sounds familiar. If it doesn't, it's very simple. Accounting balance sheets record the past. They're backward looking. Nothing wrong with that. That's their job. Financial balance sheets look forward. Accounting balance sheets break things down based on whether they're tangible or intangible, long term or short term. Financial balance sheets break assets down into whether they're already on the ground or whether you expect them to be on the ground in the future. Assets in place or growth assets. Accounting balance sheets break down debt and equity into incredible detail. Short-term debt, long-term debt, accounts payable, etc., etc. When you look at a financial balance sheet, there are only two ways to raise money to fund a business. You can borrow the money or use your own money. Debt and equity. You can dance across the line as much as you want. You can create all the hybrids you want. But a financial balance sheet is a forward-looking, dynamic balance sheet. You're saying, so what? When you sit down to value business, there are two ways you can approach valuation. One is you can wear what I call the equity hat. You focus just on the equity investors in the business. So here's what I'd like to do to make this real. You guys are going to be equity investors in a business. You guys are going to be the bank that lends money to the business. You both supply capital to the same business, right? The only difference between you is the claims you have on the cash flows. Lenders get first claims, and the claims are contractually set. Interest payments, principal payments. Equity investors get a residual cash flow. If you define it that way, things become a lot simpler. So you guys are the equity investors. You guys are the lenders. The equity investors run the business for the most part, unless you go distressed and the bankruptcy judge steps in. You get to make decisions, which creates the classic conflict of interest problem we talked about in corporate finance. You see what the conflict of interest is? What's good for you is not necessarily what's going to be good for them. And this is not a finance concept. Think about all the perverse things you can do to make yourself better off while making the bank worse off. And you can come up with a list that's really long. But guess what? The bank, if it's a sensible bank, and that's always got to be added, has thought about exactly the same list. And they're saying, you can't do that, you can't do that, you can't do that. Don't even think about doing that. So if I'm focused on valuing, on wearing my equity hat, I care just about you guys. I say the bank can take care of itself. It writes contracts, it's protected itself. It's not my job to worry about the bank. I'm going to care about just the equity investors. I'm going to look at the cash flows you get out of the business, which are the cash flows left over after you've paid the lenders. So they're post-debt cash flows. And I'm going to discount those cash flows back at the cost of equity. Sounds fancy, right? The cost of equity is the number you had in your head as the rate of return you needed to make on your equity investment to break even on this investment. Now, we're going to have to come back and wrestle with how to measure that number. But let's face it, when you buy shares in a company, you're not buying it as a charitable contribution, I hope. You're buying it because you want to make 10%, 12%, 15%, 18%. So the cost of equity is that rate of return. So if I'm equity focused, what I care about is your cash flows, your rate of return. I take your cash flows and I discount it back at what you need to make given the risk of your investment. I come up with the value of equity in the business. Now, this is a publicly traded company, and I take a very narrow view of cash flows. What's the only cash flow you as an equity investor actually get from the company? There's only one cash flow you actually get to see, which is dividends. Everything else is on paper, right? I can talk about free cash flows all I want. We say, look, the only check I got from the company last month was, or last year was, dividends. The dividend discount model is a special case of an equity valuation model. We'll come back and see how special and how constrained, but it's a special case. So that's the first way to do valuation, is to value just the equity. There's a second way to approach valuation, which is rather than value equity, I value the entire business. You see, it's becoming more expensive because what's in the business? Besides the equity, you now have the lenders. You got cash flows, which is the cash flows left over. You got cash flows in the business too, right? Interest and principal payments. What you collectively get out of this business is called the cash flow to the firm. It's actually very counterintuitive. What am I asking you to do? I'm asking you to think of the lender as a partner in this process. They get cash flows, you get cash flows. The cumulative cash flows you get out of the business is called the cash flow to the firm. That's a pre-debt cash flow, because lenders are now no longer outsiders, they're brought into the game. And if that is the cash flow I'm discounting, I can no longer just use what you demanded as a rate of return, which is the cost of equity. I have to look at the weighted average of what you demand, the cost of equity, and what you demanded, which we euphemistically call the cost of debt, but it's the interest rate you charge in the debt. That weighted average, of course, in corporate finance is the weighted average cost of capital. The cash flow to the business discounted back at the cost of capital gives me the value of the entire business. But let's say I'm still interested in just the equity because I want to buy shares in the company. I can get to the value of the equity by doing what? I need to subtract out what I owe you guys today. That's a key word. I don't want to subtract out what I might borrow from you in the future. That's irrelevant. What I've borrowed today, the debt I have outstanding today has to be subtracted out. And again, there are details we've got to wrestle with. What if I lease instead of borrowing money? We've got to define debt consistently in the cost of capital and what we subtract out. But this is your last chance to take care of anything else you as an equity investor might be worried about in this company. You're saying, like, what? If you're investing in GM, you have all those underfunded pension obligations. If you're investing in a tobacco company, there might be lawsuits hanging over your head. Those things also drain your value of equity. You subtract it out, you get to the value of equity. But you have to make up your mind up front. Are you valuing equity? Are you valuing the business? I am amazed how often I see valuations where analysts can't make up their minds. They go back and forth, back and forth. In the end, you ask them, what did you value? They have no idea. So you ready? Here's today's start of the class test. I'm going to set the table here. This was in the late 70s. There's a company called Kennecott. It's a copper mining company. And Kennecott was forced by the antitrust laws to sell its coal subsidiary. It's called Peabody. So they sold off the subsidiary. They got about $600 million in cash from the sale, which created a problem for Kennecott, because Kennecott was a $3 billion company. It has now sold off a segment of the company and got $600 million in cash. And the problem they had was they did not have a use for the cash. You see, this isn't a problem. This is a solution. What were they worried about? What was the worry they had of having so much cash in the balance sheet? Think like a manager. You're Kennecott's managers. You've now sold off a subsidiary. You've got all this cash sitting on your balance sheet. You're worried that somebody might take you over, use your cash to take you over. Now, what's the simplest and most logical solution to the problem that you have too much cash? What should you do? Give the cash back, right? That solution never even crossed their minds. So what would stockholders do with all that cash? Silly things like pay off a loan or, you know, do things that they might need to do. No, we can't allow that. So let me ask you the follow-up question. What's the stupidest way to get rid of cash quickly? It's to walk in an investment bank and say, I need to spend this cash quickly. Can you help me? And that's exactly what they did. They walked into First Boss and said, we have a lot of cash. We'd like to find somebody to buy. And First Boss said, you come to exactly the right place. And a few weeks later, they came back with the perfect target company. Perfect in what sense? It was priced at exactly how much cash you had on your balance sheet. That's another rule. You tell me how much cash you have, I'll figure out a way to spend it all. It was a company called Carborundum. It was a company that makes abrasive sandpaper, metallic abrasives. Now, this is a Harvard case, which means that at this point, if this were a Harvard case, we'd go off into the strategic speak, right? Is this the right fit? Is it a star, a cow, a dog, a pig, whatever it is? Is it fit? No. I'm not going to go there. But one of the exhibits in the case was actually the exhibit that the investment bankers used to value Carborundum for Kennecott. We're going to focus purely on valuation mechanics. In fact, in the Harvard case solution, I read it, torturous. This exhibit is not even mentioned. Why? Because it's not part of strategy speak. But let's focus on the mechanics of valuation here. It's a valuation of Carborundum. I'm going to take you through the process of how the investment banker, First Boston at the time that this was done, was the leading M&A bank on Wall Street. So this wasn't a side bank. So here's how they computed cash flows. They started with revenues. They subtracted out expenses. They subtracted out interest expenses. Now this is going to become critical to come up with net income. Then they subtract capex. So they did all the stuff you're supposed to do to get to a cash flow. But the cash flow came from by looking at cash flows after interest expenses and principal payments. So they come up with a cash flow. They discounted the cash flow. Now, before we go and look at how they discounted the cash flow, I've told you how they computed the cash flow, right? They computed the cash flow for the target company after debt payments. I'm going to give you the choices you have in terms of discount rates. And let's see if you can nail down which discount rate I should be using to discount this cash flow. If you get this, you got M&A nailed. You don't even need to take the class. Hey, you ready? Here are the choices. There are two players here. There's the acquiring company and there's the target company. The acquiring company is going to be Carborundum. The acquiring company is going to be Kennecott. The target company is Carborundum. And there's a third company that will be created after this. Let's call this Kennecott-Carborundum. It's a combined company. There's a cost of equity for each company and a cost of capital for each company. So you have six possible numbers. You have to decide which of these six numbers you would use as your discount rate for the cash flows. You say, I've never done this before. This is too complicated. Keep it simple. Think about how I computed the cash flow. The answer is going to come through to you. In fact, let me help you on the branches. These cash flows, first, cost of equity or cost of capital? And why? Because the cash flows were computed after debt payments. As simple as that. If I had computed cash flows before interest payments and before principal payments, I mean cash flow of the firm, so that gets rid of three of the numbers. So cross them out. No cost of equity, no cost of capital numbers. Now comes the critical follow-up question. Whose cost of equity? How many of you think I should use the acquiring company's cost of equity? Because it's their money. The way I asked that question kind of intimidated you, right? But come on, think about it. It's their money. It should use their cost of it. It's in fact half of all M&A valuations use the acquiring company's cost of equity on this really strange logic. If it's their money, we should use their cost of equity. They're forgetting capital budgeting 101. What should the discount rate for a project be? The discount rate should reflect the risk of the project, not the risk of the entity looking at the project. So if I came to you with a guaranteed set of cash flows, even if you're a risky company, what should you use as a discount rate for those cash flows? They're guaranteed, so they should be the risk-free rate. But I'm a risky company. I don't care. The acquiring company might come up with the money, but the discount rate should be based on the risk of what you're buying, which in this case is the target company. So the right discount rate is 16. See, what about the melded company? It doesn't matter. The melded company is what will be created after you do the acquisition. But to do this particular acquisition, you need so it's 16.5%. Now let me ask you a perverse question. If you wanted to pick the worst possible discount rate to defend logically, which would you pick? First, let's make it the acquiring company, not the target company. Let's make it the cost of capital rather than the cost of equity, right? 10.5%. Guess what First Boston used as discount rate? It used 10.5%. This is about as far as you can get from the right answer. If you set out on a path saying, let me find the worst possible discount rate here, you've landed on it. You think, so what? Discount rate? No, what does it matter? 10.5% rather than a 16.5% gives you a $660 million value. And that's what backed the acquisition of Carborundum. They went to Kennecott and said, we found the bargain for you. You can buy it at only $600 million, and we valued it at $660 million. You take their cash flows. You don't even contest a single one of their assumptions. There are a lot of bad assumptions there. You take their cash flows as a given. You apply the right discount rate. You get $450 million. And what have you just done? You've advised your client to pay $600 million for something that you have actually valued at $450 million. And for this, you get advisory fees. You know who headed the M&A department at First Boston in 1977? Joe Perella and Bruce Wasserstein. Who went on to be punished, right, by being allowed to create a boutique firm that did M&A deals. I can't make this stuff up if I tried. And how did they get punished for bringing down the process of valuation about six notches? In 1992, Dresdner Bank bought Wasserstein Perella for $3 billion. And as part of the explanation for why they paid $3 billion, they said they were doing it for Wasserstein Perella's valuation expertise. Even if you forget everything about this, here's what I want you to take away. Don't let the name on top of a valuation intimidate you. I don't care if it's Blackstone, KKR, and Goldman put together valuing a company. Look at the numbers. Don't assume that just because there's a big name on a valuation, that first principles are being followed. And before you delve into the details and talk about revenue growth and margins, make sure the first principles are not being violated, because if they are, it doesn't matter that your revenue growth is wrong or your margins are precise, because your first principles have been violated. So as a simple check, pick up a DCF that somebody's done, preferably not you because it's a little close to home. Look at the cash flows and ask, are these cash flows to equity of the firm? Then look at the discount rate and ask yourself, is this discount rate the right discount rate given the cash flows? And then finally ask yourself, what's that present value telling me? Is it giving me the value of the business, the value of the equity? So let's go back to our slides, and I'm going to jump forward on the slides a few pages because I just completed that. So I've given you two different ways of valuing equity, right? One is you can take cash flows to equity and discount at the cost of equity. The second is, actually, let me start with this. Or you can take the cash flow to the firm, discount at the cost of capital, come up with the value of the firm, subtract our debt, and get to the value of the same equity in the same firm at the same point in time. Two different ways. So here's my first question. Okay? If I value the firm and subtract our debt to get to the value of equity, should I get the same value of equity I'd have got if I'd taken cash flows to equity and discounted the cost of equity? And if not, how would you explain the difference? This is actually the weekly challenge one, right? So if you didn't try the weekly challenge, after this session at least give it a shot. Because this is, I think, one of those questions in valuation which, if you can get, you've essentially kind of cracked the code on why one approach to valuation might give you a different answer than the other. What would you like to happen? Would you like to get the same value or different values? I would like the same value, because otherwise I'm faced with this conundrum, right? Essentially, I can claim that a company is undervalued and overvalued in the same valuation by using an equity valuation. So I'd like the numbers to be the same. And I'm going to cheat a little bit and show you that the numbers are the same, but I've kind of made up this example to make them match up. And the weekly challenge actually tells you what you have to assume for the numbers to converge. So I took a company where I took cash flows to equity. Remember, those are post-debt cash flows, and cash flows of firm, which are pre-debt cash flows. So I get cash flow to equity, cash flow to the firm. This is a company with a cost of equity of 13.625%, and it can borrow money long-term at 10%. That's the pre-tax cost of debt. Market value of equity is 1,073. Market value of debt is 800 million. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this firm, and I'm first going to discount cash flows to equity at the cost of equity. So I gave you the cash flow to equity in the previous page. Cash flows to equity. Cost of equity is 13.625%. I discount the cash flows to equity, the cost of equity. I get 1,073 million. Got a value for equity. Then I took cash flow to the firm. But to discount cash flow of the firm, I need a cost of capital. And to compute the cost of capital, I took the cost of equity weighted by the proportion of equity, cost of debt after taxes weighted by the proportion of debt. I came up with a cost of capital of 9.94%. I discount cash flow to the firm at the cost of capital. I get a value for the firm of $1,873 million. I subtract out the debt. Magic. Got the same value for equity. You think this is good? I cheated, and here's how I cheated. What was my market value for equity? 1,073. What is my intrinsic value for equity? This is a company where the market value and the intrinsic value are the same. Now do you see why you will not always get the same answer? Because when you sit down to value a company, what do you use as weights? Market value for equity, market value of debt, right? But if your valuation gives you a different value than that market value, you will get different answers. Can you make them converge? Yes. We'll talk about what you would need to do. Why you would try to do that, I don't know. Because your entire objective in value in investing is what? To take advantage of that gap. But that's why you can get different answers. So which one should I pick? We'll come back and address it. Because I think there is a template you can use to pick the right way to value a business. But it's actually much more difficult than it looks to make the numbers match up. And as I said, if you can give the first weekly challenge a try, you're going to see this play out. Because there, I did not allow the two numbers to be the same. And then you got different answers. And said, why did it happen? And the answer is, if you go back and use the market value as the intrinsic value, then the problem goes away. Now, if you use any other combination, so put a big X on this page, because when you're doing your quiz, I don't want you to end up on this page and do what's described in this page. This is what you're not supposed to do. If you take cash flows to equity and discounted the cost of capital, you are going to get junk. You're saying, what if I did the cash flows really well? It doesn't matter. That's exactly what Kennicott did, right? They took cash flows to equity, discounted the cost of capital. If you take cash flows to the firm and discount the cost of equity, you're going to get a value that's too low because you've essentially discounted equity cash flows at a cost of capital. And if you forget to subtract out the debt, I don't even know what you've got. You're in this limbo where you're going to be floating around forever because you have no idea what you value. Make up your mind up front because that's what's going to drive valuation. So what I'd like to do is actually set up the big picture valuation. Because before we did, we said the next 9 sessions are going to be about the details. Let's see how these details fit together. When I sit down to value a business, I need some inputs to get the process going. And we're going to start with the discount rate. Not because it's the most important number in the entire valuation, but because it's a number that's easiest to get your hands around in terms of specifics. We're going to talk about estimating cost of equity and cost of capital. We're going to talk about estimating discount rates in different currencies, in real terms versus nominal terms. And we're also going to emphasize that discount rates can change over time when you sit down to value a company. In other words, the cost of capital you have in year one doesn't have to be the same as the cost of capital in year five, and shouldn't be. Then we're going to talk about getting your base numbers nailed down. So when I give you that 10K and say, what were your cash flows last year? Before you get ambitious about the future, let's get those numbers nailed down. So we're going to make a stop there. Then we're going to get into that place where people start to get uncomfortable. I'm going to ask you about the future. And your first reaction is, I don't know. Nobody does. That's the advantage. Nobody does, including the management of the company. You're not the only one who faces uncertainty. Deal with it. So we're going to talk about tools we can use to make those estimates for the future. And then at some point in time, I'm going to ask you to stop and tell me whether your company is a mature company. Why? Because I need closure in my valuation. I need to be able to say, okay, beyond this point in time, I'm not estimating cash flows, but don't worry. I'm not going to ignore the cash flows. I'm going to capture them all with the terminal value. So I'm going to emphasize the process of estimating the terminal value and how to make sure that that number doesn't run away from you. Because if you're not careful, that number can very quickly start to run your entire valuation. And when the process is all done, we'll talk about the right discounted cash flow to model to pick, equity or firms, you know, growth or stable. Okay? So you can already see the layers of choices expand in front of you. So in a generic discounted cash flow model, here are the drivers of value. There are cash flows that you got to predict. Those cash flows can either be pre-debt or post-debt. Pre-debt are firm cash flows, post-debt are equity. Your discount rate can either be cost of capital, if you're looking at the entire firm, or cost of equity. Your growth rate has to be growth either in pre-debt earnings, if you're looking at the firm, or post-debt earnings. Now, do you see why you have to make your choice up front? Because if you don't decide whether you're valuing equity of the firm, at each stage in the estimation process, you're going to face a problem. So you choose to value the firm, your cash flows will be pre-debt, your discount rate will be cost of capital, your growth rate will be growth in operating income, and you got to tell me when your company will become a mature company. If your cash flows are equity cash flows, your cash flows will have to be post-debt cash flows, your discount rate has to be a cost of equity, your growth has to be growth in equity income, and you still have to tell me when your company becomes a mature company. So I'm going to take you through three big picture valuations, starting with the simplest way to value equity, which is to focus on dividends. The dividend discount model is the oldest discounted cash flow model that we know about. I think the first mention of the model was in 1938, John Williams writing a book. So the dividend discount model has been around a long time. The only problem is there are a lot of people who claim to know DCF who still hold on to the dividend discount model as the only model that they work with. So let's look at the dividend discount model. Let's see the inputs. Your cash flows now are dividends. So all you have to focus on is projecting dividends into the future, which actually gives you more comfort, right? The dividends are there. You can make an estimate. You can look at the history. So your cash flows become dividends. Your growth rate becomes growth in equity earnings and the dividends that come out of those earnings, because dividends have to be paid out of net income. Your discount rate is a cost of equity. Dividends are equity cash flows. And you got to tell me at what point in time your dividends will start to grow at a constant rate forever, because that's what will allow me to compute that terminal value. And if I discount all the dividends back to today at the cost of equity, I have the value of equity in the company today. So in the dividend discount model, if I ask you to value Coca-Cola, you're going to project the dividends out. At some point in time, you're going to say the dividends are going to grow at 2% a year forever. You come up with a value for dividends beyond that point in time. You discount them all back. At the cost of equity, you end up with the value of equity in the company. Oldest discounted cash flow model around. But it has a fundamental problem, which is it's built on the presumption that companies pay out what they can afford to in dividends. And we have conclusive proof, absolute proof, that that is not true. And it's not debatable. What's the proof that gives away what is the proof that companies don't pay out what they can afford to in dividends? It's very simple. If companies paid out what they could in dividends, what cash balance should you see in every company? It should be close to zero, right? So there you go. So there's no debate to have. Of course they don't. Which means if you use the dividend discount model to value stocks, you are going to undervalue them, at least in the US. But I think across the world, you're going to undervalue companies more often than overvalue them. Because you're looking at a number that's too low. Because you're missing that it is. So if I took Apple and said, or Google, and said, look, I'm going to take dividends. They don't pay dividends. In fact, if you get this logical extreme, Google's worth nothing. You made your valuation job really simple. 90% of the world is worth nothing. The remaining 10% is undervalued. So you're going to be buying what? Phone companies and utilities till they go out of style? So it would be nice if we could replace dividends with potential dividends. You think, that's going to be really difficult. What are potential dividends? It's whatever cash is left over after you've met every conceivable need. And in corporate finance, we did come up with a measure, right? We called it free cash flow to equity, which is basically the cash left over after CapEx, after working capital, after debt payments. So in the free cash flow to equity model, you replace dividends with free cash flow to equity. It's not fancy. We replace dividends, actual dividends, potential dividends. It's more work because you now have to estimate those potential dividends. You're still working with equity cash flows, but you now have to project out net income growth, net capex growth, the items you need for free cash flow to equity. You're going to discount those cash flows back still at the cost of equity. And what you get as a present value will be the value of equity in this business. And if you've just looked at the net income from non-cash assets, from operating assets, you have to bring in cash and cross-holdings. And we'll talk about when you add cash and cross-holdings back and when you don't. But it depends on how you computed the free cash flow equity. Dividend discount model to free cash flow equity model. Which brings us to the final variant. Rather than looking at cash flows to equity, which are the cash flows left over after debt payments, I could look at cash flows before debt payments, right? Which is free cash flow to the firm. If that's the cash flow I'm focusing on, the growth has to be in those free cash flows, a pre-debt cash flow. Your discount rate has to be a cost of capital. And still a point in time you make the company a stable growth company and discount them back. Put these three pages, when you get a chance, next to each other. What I want you to see is how much there is in common. All that's different is how we define cash flows and how we come up with discount rates, right? People tend to think, oh, there are so many discounted cash flow models out there. There aren't. If you look past the differences, they have a lot more in common than they're different. And that's basically what we're going to work towards, is to come up with the input so you can use any of these models. And you have to be facile enough that you can go and say, I'm going to pull this model out for this company. Don't get stuck where you say, I can use only this model. You have to be able to move across the models, and it's not difficult to do. So we're going to start today on discount rates. In fact, it'll take us about 3 to 4 sessions just focusing on discount rates. Let's start off by looking at some of the questions we have to address. Okay? First is, as I said, don't make this front and center, the thing you worry about. Don't finesse your discount rate to the point that you're not spending any time in the cash flows. Discount rates matter, but they don't matter as much as you think they do. Doesn't mean you shouldn't spend time coming up with a discount rate, but don't get obsessed with them. We're going to talk about consistency with discount rates. We've started the discussion already with this equity firm thing, which is if your cash flows are to equity, your discount rate has to be a cost of equity. Cash flow to the firm, your discount rate has to be a cost of capital. We're going to expand on that consistency question. If your cash flows are in U.S. dollars, your discount rate has to be in U.S. dollars as well. If your cash flows are in pesos, your discount rate has to be in pesos. If your cash flows are real, your discount rate has to be real. And we'll talk about what that even means. But we're going to bring in currency today and actually deal with it, get it out of the way. And it's not difficult once you crack the code in currencies. We're also going to talk about, you know, as we said, nominal and real, basically what happens if you take inflation out. But we're going to talk about those consistency issues. So let's set the table for discount rates. If you look at a classic discounted cash flow valuation, in the numerator you have expected cash flows. Expected. So what does that mean? You got to look across scenarios, good and bad. These are not conservative cash flows. These are not best case valuation. Do not, when you value a company, sit down and say, I'm going to do a worst case valuation. You can do that after you've done your base value, but you have to start with the base case. This is my expectation. So numerator is expected cash flows. It's not a place you're going to adjust for risk. You're going to adjust for all the different scenarios you face, but that's not risk adjustment. It's probability times cash flow. Expected cash flow. The discount rate is where risk comes in. And I'm going to break down discount rate before you delve into models into the following components. One is you need a base from which you have to build off discount rate. So you need a risk-free rate in your currency. Easier in some than others. In fact, today we're going to deal with that question. That's the first step. Second, you need a measure of relative risk for the company or asset you value. Relative to other assets, more risky or less risky. That's what a beta does, right? So don't make this about fancy Greek alphabets. Think about it as a measure of relative risk. And third, you need to tell me what you would demand as a risk premium for the average risk investment. So that's how we're going to frame our discussion, is we're going to start with the risk-free rate, work to the risk premium, and back into betas. But before we do that, let's take a step back and think about uncertainty. I kind of brought this up in the very first session. I said, this is going to bedevil you through these entire 15 weeks, and it'll bother you more if you're a numbers person used to precision than it will if you're a story person. So part of this class is about getting used to dealing with uncertainty. In fact, one of the things I find cathartic when I sit down to value a company where there's a lot of risk, in fact, I did a Uber updated valuation yesterday, is I made a risk profile, a list of everything that bothered me. It's cathartic because you can keep writing and writing and writing. This bothers me, that bothers me. So make an entire list. And if you're being honest with yourself, you're going to see 50 items, 60 items on the list. If I ask you to value even a Lukoil, think of all the things you worry about, right? Russian oil company, corporate governance in Russia, will Putin go crazy? Now, all those things, put them all down. This is your moment in the sun. And then after you made this list, I'd like you to start putting it into buckets. And here are the buckets I'd like you to think about. First, think about whether this uncertainty is economic uncertainty or estimation uncertainty. You're saying, what's the difference? Let's say you're valuing a Greek shipping company. Which uncertainty do you think is greater? Economic uncertainty comes from the outside. Think of it as, I use the word karmic very, very sparingly, but this is, karmic is, this is risk you can't control. It comes from outside. Estimation uncertainty is things you can do about it. Go do your homework, collect more information. When you're valuing a Greek shipping company, which do you think is going to be more dominant? It's economic uncertainty. 90% of the risk you face has nothing to do with you. You can sit here and do all the research you want, collect all the information. That uncertainty is not going to go away. And that's actually the first step in release, right? Because once you recognize that 80% of the items in the list you can do nothing about, what's the point in worrying about them? The second set of baskets I'd like you to think about, is it micro uncertainty or macro uncertainty? I'll give you an example of Uber. Micro uncertainty is we're not sure what the management of this company will do. Micro uncertainty is what Lyft will do in Los Angeles versus Uber. Micro uncertainty is uncertainty that revolves around the company and its immediate environs. Macro uncertainty is worrying about what the Fed will do next week. Interest rates, economic growth, inflation, political risk. Micro versus macro. You think, who cares? Only one of these uncertainties actually shows up in your discount rate. If you're valuing a publicly traded company. Private businesses, the rules are different. In a publicly traded company, only one of these two shows up. Which one? Give it a shot, 50-50. Micro or macro? They sound alike, so I'm going to act like you said macro. Because macro is the right answer, and here's why. What's the essence of micro uncertainty? It can cut in different ways for different. So you value 50 companies for your portfolio. Micro uncertainty, in some companies you're going to underestimate what managers do, and other companies you're going to overestimate it. Micro uncertainty averages out across a portfolio. I know it's tough to let go. Worrying about what the mental health of a CEO is going to be, nothing I can do about it, right? Basically, that's the kind of uncertainty that's going to average out across my investments. If every CEO of every company I invest in goes crazy, that's more a message to me than, you know, somebody up there doesn't like me. Right? So micro uncertainty averages out, macro doesn't. And finally, I'm going to ask you, is this uncertainty discrete or continuous? You know what continuous uncertainty is? You're exposed to it all of the time. You're a U.S. company with substantial cash flows from Europe. Every minute of every day, your cash flows change, right? Why? Because every time the dollar-euro exchange rate changes, your cash flows are changing, your value is changing. That's continuous uncertainty. But let's say you get 40% of your cash flows from a country with fixed exchange rates. Say Indonesia. Most of the time, nothing changes, right? Until everything changes. You get big devaluations. So continuous risk tends to be continuous and small. Discrete risk often tends to be discrete and catastrophic. Which risk would you rather be dealing with in valuation? We're very good at dealing with continuous risk. All the models out there for finance are models designed for continuous risk, which is cash flows varying across time. We're horrible at the way we deal with discrete risk. If I give you a Venezuelan company, what's the risk that should worry you? What should be up front and center? That your business might not be your business in 3 days. It could be nationalized. That's discrete risk. It's very difficult to bring into discount rates, very difficult to bring into traditional valuation, but we're going to have to face it somewhere along this process and say, how do we value companies that face substantial discrete risk? It could be terrorism risk. It could be nationalization risk. It could be the risk that you could default. That's discrete risk. So first step is think about not all uncertainty is made alike. It can come in different forms, put into different groupings. And here are the three basic themes that are going to underlie how we think about risk. Not all risk matters. As I said, if you're an investor and you invest in a company, The risk you care about is the risk it adds to your portfolio, not the risk of the company standing alone. So we're going to parse through these risks, and we're going to discover that not all risks get built into discount rates. Some risks will show up. Second is we have to ask about whose risks should we be thinking about. Let me explain. You're valuing IBM. So when you sit down to value IBM, you say, look, I have no money, so if I invest in IBM, all my money is going to go into IBM. Therefore, all risk matters. Don't go there. And here's the reason why. When you buy IBM, it's a publicly traded company. Its price is set by whom? Not by you or I buying 1,000 shares. It's set by State Street, BlackRock, and Fidelity buying 1 million shares. So when you think about risk, it's, again, very tough to do. It's not about you. It's about those people and how they think about risk, those people being the marginal investors in the company. And that's actually a disconnect that you have to be willing to make, that this is not how risky is this company to me. And this is where I part ways with intrinsic value investors who are true, who have this fetish about it's all about me and I have to think about my... It's not about you. This is a publicly traded company. You have to look at risk through their eyes. And that's where the diversification story kicks in. You don't have to buy into every aspect of modern portfolio theory. In fact, I don't buy into lots of modern portfolio theory. But here's one thing that I know is true, which is as investors diversify, the way they think about risk changes. So when we look at these, especially the large market cap companies in emerging markets, where the marginal investor is often a foreign institutional investor, I think that risk, the way we think about risk in these companies has changed forever, and we have to be realistic about it. That if you're investing in Tata Motors or Infosys, it's not what you or I think about risk, it's what those foreign institutional investors who come in waves think about risk and can drive how we measure risk. So if you look at the different models for risk, and as I said, this is for a different forum. I really think about these purely as tools. So to me, whether I use any of these models really depends on what kind of discount rate they yield for me. Let's start with the choices. You can go back to the oldest risk and return model in modern portfolio theory, which is the CAPM. Well, you have only three inputs to get the cost of equity for a company: a risk-free rate, a beta measuring relative risk, and an equity risk premium, and you're done. But it's built on the presumption of supreme diversification, that all of the risk is captured in that one beta. There are arbitrage pricing models and multi-factor models, which you can think of as expanded versions of the CAPM, where instead of one market risk, you have five market risks. Instead of one beta, you have five betas. But they're still trying to do exactly the same thing, measure the risk to a diversified investor. And finally, you have what I call proxy models, where essentially you look at the past, and you look at what kinds of companies have earned high returns in the past, small cap companies, low price to book companies. And you essentially come up with an expected return given the characteristics of the company. Every risk and return model you will see out there uses some variant of one of these models or a combination of the two. What do I mean by a combination of the two? In fact, the most common way in which cost of equity is estimated is you see risk-free rate plus beta times risk premium. So right up till now, you're on the CAPM, right? And then you'll add a small cap premium, which many people do for small companies. And what have you done when you do that? You brought in a proxy model on top of the CAPM to kind of capture, you know. I'm not saying any of these are right or wrong, but the destination is the same in all of these. I need a risk-adjusted discount rate. So I'm going to focus on the CAPM, not because it's the only model out there, but everything I say about the CAPM you can expand to the arbitrage. So if you decide to go on, be my guest. In fact, I don't even care if you use any of these models. I'll give you alternatives to all of these models, but ultimately, I need a risk-adjusted discount rate. And in the CAPM, I need a risk-free rate, I need a beta, and I need an equity risk premium. And in practice, people, it's amazing how much they screw up this very simple process. First, they'll take it as a given that if I give you a government security rate, I've given you a risk-free rate, that a government bond rate is a risk-free rate. That's the way I was taught risk-free rates. Absolutely horrible advice, but that's what I was told. Second, that the best way to estimate equity risk premiums is to look at the past, historical risk premiums. And third, I was taught the way you get a beta is you run a regression of returns on the stock against returns on the market index. You take the slope of the line, you're done. All bad practices. Let's start with the first one, risk-free rate. The essence of a risk-free rate is you know exactly what you're going to make with certainty. That's what you need for something to be risk-free. So for something to be risk-free, it's got to meet two conditions. First is, there can be no default risk in the entity issuing the security. So file that away, because we'll have to come back and deal with that. And second is, there can be no reinvestment risk. You know what I mean by reinvestment risk? If I have a 5-year cash flow, a 6-month T-bill is not risk-free because at the end of 6 months, I've got to reinvest again. So it's default-free maybe, but it's not risk-free. Even a 5-year bond is not risk-free with a 5-year cash flow. Why not? What do I get every 6 months in a 5-year bond? I get coupons, and I have to reinvest those coupons at rates I don't know. So if I were a purist, getting a risk-free rate is going to be tedious because I need something that's cash flow matched, time matched, and default-free. I'm not going to go down that route yet, but here are two very simple implications that emerge just from that assumption. First is, when you ask me what the risk-free rate is, before I answer, what's the first question I need to ask you? What currency? Over what time period? Right? Because you can't answer, what's a risk-free rate? There's no global risk-free rate. What currency? What time period? If you say US dollars in 6 months, the answer you're going to get is very different than if you say Indian rupees over 10 years. And second, and this is stating the obvious, might as well state it, just because you have a government bond rate doesn't mean you have a risk-free rate. Now, I'll give you 3 words that if you can repeat 10 times every night for the next 10 nights, you'll be cured of that disease of thinking that just because you have a government bond rate means you have a risk-free rate. And here are the 3 words you need to repeat. And you have to be religious about this. For the next 10 nights, here are the 3 words you have to say. Greek government bond. Greek government bond. Say it 10 times. In fact, you can switch. Tomorrow you can say Argentine government bond, Argentine government bond. At the end, pick different governments, you know. And by the 10th night, you will never again use the word government bond rate and risk-free as interchangeable. Are some governments close to default-free? Yes. But you can't assume that every government is default-free, because they're not. So I'm going to take you through a series of very simple tests that are going to kind of bring out the essence of a risk-free rate. So let's assume that you've estimated cash flows for everything. I never do that. Effectively, you do, right? In a traditional discounted cash flow valuation, what do? You project cash flows for the next 10 years. And then in the terminal value, assume your cash flows will keep growing at 2% a year forever. So almost every valuation, really, your cash flows are forever. So keeping in mind what I told you about risk-free rates, the essence of risk-free rates, and this is a valuation in US dollars, I want a risk-free rate to use on this valuation. Should I use a 3-month T-bill? So with each one, tell me whether you'd use it, and if you will not use it, why you would not use it. Can I use a 3-month T-bill rate as my risk-free rate? What's wrong with it? Time matching, right? I have infinite cash flows, 3 months doesn't. So you'd like that you'd get a long term. And so if I had to pick one rate, I want a longer term rate rather than a shorter term rate. So let me jump to what seems like the right answer, which is the longest term rate, 30-year T-bond rate. I'll make a confession. You're not going to see a single valuation over the next 15 weeks where I use the 30-year T-bond rate. I'm going to use the 10-year T-bond rate as my risk-free rate. And I'm not doing it because 10 is better than 30 or 10 is higher than 30. Obviously, it's not. I'm doing it for convenience, and here's why. If all I had to do was estimate a risk-free rate in U.S. dollars for the long term, I'd use the 30-year T-bond rate. But that's not all I'm doing. What else do I have to use this risk-free rate for? Is to come up with a cost of equity, or I need an equity risk premium. To get a cost of debt, I need a default spread. So I have to think ahead and think, hey, how difficult is it going to be, or how easy is it going to be to get those numbers? So let's think about default spreads for bonds. How do we get them? We compare a corporate bond rate to the risk-free rate, right? So to get the default spread, with a 30-year T-bond, I would have to find 30-year corporates and I can't find those. When I do equity risk premiums, I have to find 30-year T-bond rates going back 75 years, and for 60 of those years, they're only 10-year bonds, not 30-year bonds, so I can't do that. So if you ask me, can I pick one risk-free rate in the perfect, I'd say go with the 30-year bond rate, but then I'd say, look, if for your own convenience, you probably want to go back to a 10-year bond rate. It's not going to be that different. The term structure starts to flatten out by the time you get there, and the other inputs will make up for it. So I use 10-year T-bond rate, and when I do that, what am I implicitly assuming about the U.S. Treasury? Might as well make it explicit. Come on, what's the second condition that you need for something to be risk-free? No reinvestment risk and no default risk, right? So I'm implicit. Is that the safe assumption? 7 years ago, it is, of course, no. But remember that summer of 2012? You were doing something else. But S&P downgraded the U.S. Treasury. And there's all this incredible commotion that that created. The genie's now out of the bottle. You can't assume just because you have the U.S. Treasury that it's default free. There will be a day where you might have to adjust the U.S. Treasury for default risk. And I'm ready for that day. But for the moment, I'm going to act like S&P doesn't exist and use Moody's. And look, Moody says it's AAA. It makes my life so much easier for the moment. But it is an assumption. I'm assuming the U.S. Treasury is default free, and I'm using the 10-year bond rate. You're saying, what about the TIPS rate? Have you heard of, you know, you're familiar with the TIPS market? It's an inflation-protected T-bond. Basically, the rate on that bond right now is about 0.5%, 0.7%. So if you buy that bond, here's what you get as a coupon. You get 0.7% plus whatever the inflation is that year. So next year, if there's no inflation, you'll get only 0.7. The year after, there's 5% inflation, you get 5.7%. It's not a nominal rate, it's a real rate. So later in this process, I'm going to ask you, can I use it as a real risk-free rate? And maybe the answer is yes. But on this discussion, because I'm doing everything in nominal U.S. dollars, it's not even in the discussion. So is everybody comfortable with why I picked the 10-year? So the 10 of the 30 you can get away with. In both, you're assuming the U.S. Treasury is default free. I'm going to go with the 10 purely for pragmatic reasons. Now let's move one step up the difficulty ladder. I want a risk-free rate in euros. Should be easy, right? Go find a government bond denominated in euros. And I did, and I found quite a few. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 governments. All of which have issued 10-year bonds denominated in euros. Remember, this is not 1997. We're not talking about drachma bonds and French franc bonds and and Deutsche. These are all euro bonds, all 10-year bonds, all government bonds. The rates are all different. Why are they different? Well, it's the same currency, same maturity. The only reason left for difference is perceptions of default risk, right? So let me ask you a question. And to me, the answer seems obvious, but it's amazing how often I have to debate this. If I asked you to value a Spanish company in euros, which of these rates would you use as your risk-free rate? Let me play devil's advocate. Why can't I use the Spanish 10-year bond rate? Because I'm trying to get a risk-free rate, and it seems to be an internal contradiction to take a rate that you just said has default risk in it and claim that it's a risk-free rate. I'm going to use the German. What if I'm valuing that Greek shipping company in euros? What risk-free rate should I use? This is going to make you uncomfortable, but stay consistent. It should still be the German. But it's a Greek company. I want to punish it. I'll give you plenty of chances to beat these companies up down the road. Don't do it here. The risk-free rate is not the place to bring out all your worries about country risk into the process. It's purely based on currency. So if I ask you to value Lukoil in euros, I should still be using the German 10-year bond rate. If I ask you to value Lukoil in U.S. dollars, I should be using the 10-year U.S. T-bond rate. So once you pick a currency, the risk-free rate is defined by that currency. Let's make things a little more messy. I want a risk-free rate in Indian rupees. So I went and did my job. I found an Indian government bond, 10-year, it's a rupee-denominated bond. That has to be critical. You can't give you a dollar-denominated bond. The rate on that bond was 7.87%. I'm home free, right? I've got my risk-free rate in rupees, but before I do that, what do I have to check? I have to check and make sure there's no default risk in it. So I went to the Moody's website, and I looked up the sovereign rating for India, and they gave me two, one for a foreign currency rating and the other is a local currency rating. The foreign currency rating I ignored because that's how much risk Moody's sees when India issues bonds in dollars or euros. I was focused on the local currency rating. I was hoping and praying it would be a AAA. It was a Baa3. Not terrible, but it's not AAA. So if I trust Moody's, and that's a big dangerous if, what's Moody's telling me? That there is default risk even in the local currency. So how can there be default risk in the local currency? Play devil's advocate. Tell me why there can be no default risk in the local currency. What should governments be able to do that eliminates default risk? Print the money, right? In fact, that's a classic counter. How can there be default risk in the local currency? Just print the money. My counter to you on that one is, over the last 100 years, there have been at least 25 sovereign defaults in the local currency. One of the most infamous ones was in 1997 when Russia defaulted on its local currency bonds but actually paid its foreign currency obligations. Tells you something about how the Russian government thinks about its own citizens relative to the rest of the world at that point in time. You say, why would you do that? It's true, you can run your printing presses faster to pay off your debt, but what's the cost of doing that? You debase your currency, right? And if you debase your currency a lot, people stop trusting the currency. What do? They convert currency into real goods. Lettuce is better than the currency. Let me convert everything I can. It's happened with hyperinflation. Something that Paul Krugman should read about before he gets this deflation thing out of his system is inflation can be deadly. Anybody from Latin America can tell you how long it takes for a currency to recover being debased. So that's a choice you face. It's a bad choice either way, right? You can either run the printing presses faster and debase your currency, or you can default. And guess what? Some governments decide that default is a better option than debasing a currency. So don't assume just because it's a local currency bond that there will be no default. So the Baa3 tells me that Moody's thinks that there's default risk in India. So the 7.87% is not risk-free, right? Some of it is for default risk. If I could only estimate how much of it is default risk, I'd be home free. So what if I told you, and we'll come back and I'll come back and explain how I came up with the number. What if I told you that a Baa3 sovereign bond typically carries a default spread of about 2.2%? For the moment, you say, how the hell do you know that? We'll talk about ways of it. But let's say you knew that. Can you now give me a risk-free rate in Indian rupees? And I'll give you the choices. I can stay with the 7.87% on this local currency argument. I could add the 2.2% to it, or subtract the 2.2. If you can come up with more creative choices, come up with a multiply, divide, whatever. But to me, those seem to be the three choices. Stick with the 7.87, add it, subtract it. How many of you would stick with the 7.87%? Nobody, you're going to have a lot of fights on your hands. Because the conventional practice in most countries now, in almost 95%, analysis is to stay with the government bond as risk-free. But be willing to fight that fight. I've given you the argument. If you want to give up on the fight, that's your choice to make. Let's look at the other two choices. How many of you would add the 2.2%? Okay. Let's take the adding the 2.2%. What am I trying to do?
Factoring for the risk.
Actually, I'm trying to factor out. Not factor in, right? But the 7.87%, remember, has it factored in? I want to take it out. So if I add the 2.2%, I'm actually double counting default risk. The 7.87% already includes it. Adding an extra 2.2% actually double includes it. So I should be taking it out, which effectively means that my risk-free rate in rupees is going to be 7.87 minus the 2.2, which is 5.67%. Sounds like a lot of work to get to the risk-free rate. But you're going to see later on, when we get to equity risk premiums, why, if you don't do this, you're going to double count risk. Now, let me talk a little bit about how I came up with the 2.2%. There are three pathways, and if you remember, I did this in the corporate finance class as well, but no harm repeating it. There are three pathways to get a sovereign default spread. One is to find a sovereign dollar or euro-denominated bond issued by that government. You think, how will that help me? If I can find a dollar-denominated bond issued by India and I compare it to the UST bond rate, that difference is actually a measure of the market-driven default spread. The second is a market of more recent origins, called the CDS market, the credit default swap market. Think of it as an insurance market. There's a sovereign CDS market where you can go in and buy insurance, and the insurance price is stated in percentage terms per year. So that's how much you'd have to pay. So the sovereign CDS market says 1.5%. You'd have to pay 1.5% of your coupon to that insurer for the insurance, and you'd be protected against default risk, at least on paper. And the third is to create some kind of smoothed out spread. What I do is I take all 70 or 80 countries for which I have sovereign spreads that I've computed the first two approaches, and I take the ratings for each country. Have you ever used the pivot table in Excel? Basically, and I do a pivot table. Basically, it says, what's a typical spread for Baa1, Baa2, Baa3? So three different approaches. Let me show you how each of the three would work out. And I'm going to use Brazil as an example that has already become outdated because of what's happened over the last 9 months. So I'm going to leave you, maybe this week's weekly challenge will be about Brazil. Let's make that about Brazil. Okay. So January 2015, I went and found local currency government bond rates. I'll send you the link to this page from which I pulled this off. It's incredibly useful to have it, and it's free for the moment. Okay? So I pulled up the local. So let's focus on Brazil. So according to this table, Brazil, right there, 12.42%. It's the 10-year Brazilian nominal real-denominated bond rate. So what's you see the rest of my job is, right? I have to figure out the default spread for Brazil so I can take it out of this 12.42%. So let's try the first approach. If you've ever looked at the FT in the markets page, there's this little section that lists high yield and emerging market bonds. It shows up every single weekday in the FT. So what these are bonds issued by governments in other currencies. So there are emerging market US dollar bonds. Let's go with the 2020 bond. Of course, there are multiple Brazils because depending on you have short-term bonds, long-term. I'm going to go with as long-term a bond I can find. The longest term I can find for Brazil is a January 2020 bond. There's a coupon rate. Forget about all of these. Go right across to this number right there, 3.20%. According to the FT, on the day that I looked this up, the interest rate, and market interest rate on a dollar-denominated Brazilian bond expiring January 2020 was 3.2%. Now, what do I need to get a default spread? I need to figure out what the US T bond rate expiring on the same day was. So I found the January 2020 US T bond. And on that day that I looked up the 3.2%, the US T bond rate was 1.65%. So I'm matching up maturities. They're both dollar-denominated bonds. And the difference, 1.55%, is an estimate of the default spread for Brazil on January 1st. Of 2020. You know what that number looks like today? It's close to 3%. So what's changed? Well, you got to visit Brazil to find out. Okay. So that's the first thing. Risk has changed. It's become more, so the spread shows up. Any question on the first approach? So this works if you can find a dollar bond. In fact, the FT really screws up in the way it computes spreads. It's okay. The way it computes spreads versus the US, I'm okay with. It screws up when it does the emerging euro bonds. Do you see why it screws up? It found forward. Let's say, for instance, it found a Mexico euro-denominated bond. It found a rate on that bond and then gives you the spread versus the U.S. dollar bond. What should the spread be against? There should be against German euro. People are not always consistent, so be careful. Just because you see something in a paper doesn't mean that they know what they're doing. So that's the first approach. Here's the second one. You can look up the CDS spread for your country. And I can find CDS spreads for about 62 countries now, and the list keeps expanding each year. So remember what these are. These are the prices you're going to pay on an annual basis for insurance against default. So let's focus on Brazil again. Brazil, on the day that I did this, had a CDS spread of 3.17%. So these are market set rates. They change every minute of every day. So that's a plus, that's a minus. But the CDS market has one small or big problem. There's counterparty risk. You know what I mean by counterparty risk? You buy insurance. Your insurance is only as good as the insurer, right? In fact, that's why the Lehman default almost killed this market, because Lehman had this huge billions and billions of dollars of outstanding insurance they'd sold in the CDS market. And anybody who bought insurance from Lehman, when Lehman went under, said, oh, what the heck do I do now? Which effectively means that when you see CDS spreads, there's going to be a component of that that's got nothing to do with default risk. It reflects this counterparty risk. So how the heck are you going to find out what that is? I looked across markets. If you look across the market, 62 countries, Switzerland is there, US is there. There isn't a single market with a CDS spread of zero, right? So if you believe the CDS market, there is no default-free entity in the world. So I picked the US. The CDS spread is 0.31%. I can take that to mean that there is default risk in the US, or I can take that to mean that this captures what the CDS spread would be if I took all default risk out and left the remaining risk in, the counterparty risk. I know it's a stretch, but I'm going to treat the 0.31% as almost a number I need to take out of every spread. So you see the 2.86%, that's the 3.17% I got for Brazil, minus the 0.31% for the US, and I subtract that from each number. So think of that as a purer measure of default risk, but I'm using the CDS market to estimate it. So at this stage, I have two different estimates of the default risk for Brazil. 1.55% from the government bond rate, 2.86% from the CDS market. But I'm not quite done. I have this lookup table I told you about, and the way I told you how I got the lookup table is with the pivot table. I know the rating for Brazil is Baa3. The default spread for a Baa3 rated country is 2.2%. So I have a third estimate of the default risk, which is a bit of a problem, right? Because three different numbers, and I get to pick, I have to decide which one I'm going to pick. And I'm going to tell you something that's going to sound incredibly weird, but I'll back it up. Pick any one of them, but stay consistent. You think, in what sense? Later, when I ask you about the equity risk premium, I'm going to build off the spread again. And whatever spread you picked here has to be the spread you picked there as well. So as an example, if I took the 1.55% default spread, my risk-free rate in reais is going to be much higher than if I picked the 2.86% default spread, right? I don't know. Brazil had a Baa2 rating. I've already downgraded it when it wasn't in January 2015. It was 1.9%. So 1.55, 2.86, and 1.9%. I get very different risk-free rates, right? So if you just pick based on risk-free rates and you wanted to push up the value of a company in reais, which one are you going to go with? The biggest spread or the smallest spread? You're going to go with the biggest spread. You say, this is good. You know where I'm going to come back and catch you? Later on, when I ask you how much of a risk premium are you going to estimate for Brazil, guess what? I'm going to latch on to that 2.86%. I'm not going to let you go back to the 1.55% there, which means that what one hand gives you, the other hand will take away. So I don't care which approach you latch on to. Pick one and be consistent. But in all of these, you're trying to get that default spread to take out of the government bond rate to get to risk-free rate. Any questions on this process? Now let's talk about real risk-free rates. In Latin America, until a few years ago, nobody worked in local currency numbers, especially nominal values. Nobody. Brazil equity research was done in US dollars. Why? Because nobody wanted to deal with, hey, how do I come up with a risk-free rate in nominal reais? Often they would do what they called real analysis, which means they take inflation out of the cash flows and project out based on number of units, which is fine. But if you do your cash flows in real terms, you've taken inflation out, then currency is out of the picture. You need a real risk-free rate. Earlier I gave you the TIPS rate, the 1%. That is actually a real risk-free rate, but you're saying it's in dollars. You know what? Once a risk-free rate is real, currency actually drops out of the equation. So I'll give you the easy answer. If you ask me what should be the real risk-free rate for a Brazilian capital budgeting project I've done in real cash flows, you can use the 1%. But they'll tell you what the hand-waving you have to do after that is. That works only if you assume free flow of capital across markets. Do you see why that'll equate real risk-free rates across countries? Because if I have a real risk-free rate of 5% in Brazil and 1% in the US, and capital flows freely, leave the 1%. We know that's not true, but the alternative is so mind-bogglingly difficult that my suggestion is use the 1%, wave your hands a lot, throw in a few economic buzzwords, move on, before they can even react to what you've just said. Real risk-free rates are really tough to get. The tips rate is the starting point, but I think that's something we have to start thinking about when you think about real cash flows and real discount rates. You say, what if I don't have a default free entity? It's 80% of the world, right? Could be 100% soon. In fact, right after the 2008 crisis, I wrote a series of papers that I called my nightmare papers, which is basically I took things I took for granted and said, what if that's not true? And the first paper I wrote is, what if nothing is risk-free? What if I wake up tomorrow and there isn't a risk-free entity? What do I do? It's not the end of the world. It's a little messier than I'd like it to be. But it could happen. If you're working with a currency where there's no default free entity, here are your choices. You can do what I just did. Start with a local government bond and work down to risk-free rate, right? Take out the default spread, come up with the risk-free rate. You can do your analysis in real terms and use the TIPS rate as your risk-free rate. Or you can cop out and do your entire valuation in different currency. Now, do you see why I value Lukoil in US dollars? Rather than deal with everything in rubles, I convert into dollars. And with Lukoil, it was relatively simple because what do they sell? Oil into a dollar-denominated market. It's going to be much more difficult if I decide to do this for Severstal or, you know, a Russian company that gets its cash flows in rubles. But those are your three choices. Now let's talk about what to do if you don't trust the government bond rate. A few weeks ago, I got an email from somebody valuing a company in Chinese renminbi, and the Chinese government bond rate is about 3.5%. And he said, I don't trust that rate as a risk-free rate. In fact, that can be said about the Indian government bond rate as well. And the reason is very simple. Unlike the US T-bond, which is this hugely traded market, you can have all the conspiracy theories you want about the Fed. But the market is huge and liquid. Many government bonds are not deep and liquid markets. The Indian government bond rate, for instance, is stage managed because Indian banks are required to buy those bonds as part of the reserves. The Chinese government bond rate is in a much, much narrower, smaller market. So he said, I don't trust the 3.5%. You know what drives that mistrust? Is if you're in a market where inflation is 5 or 6 or 8% and the government bond rate is 3.5%, you know that something is off, right? So he said, what do I do? I said, I have a very simple, maybe not that simple a solution. I said, do your cost of capital or your risk-free rate in US dollars. You can get that, right? Take the treasury, right? And then remember a fundamental principle about currencies, which is, the risk-free rate in a currency just reflects differential inflation. In other words, if you can tell me what the inflation in China is, and you say, look, I don't trust the official number, it's 8%, and the inflation in the US is 1%, I'm done. I just take the US risk-free rate, add roughly 7% to it, and I get a risk-free rate in the local currency. It's actually a very effective way of thinking about risk-free rates in different currencies. I've actually used the full adjustment, which is a compounding effect. So in this case, for instance, if my risk-free rate in US dollars is 3%, the inflation rate in the local currency is 15. I could add the 15 minus 2, which is 13 to the 3, but the compounding effect actually makes it worse. The actual risk-free rate in the local currency is going to be 16.17%, a little higher than what I've got with the approximation. But if you use the approximation, it's not the end of the world. So even if you can't find a government bond or you don't trust the government bond rate, remember that there is that option you have of building up the risk-free rate. Here's the other option. I call this the build-up risk-free rate. I'm going to argue that the risk-free rate in any currency is composed of two components, the expected inflation in that currency and an expected real interest rate. It's called the Fisher equation. I know Econ 101, you get taught that somewhere along the way. So you can actually estimate a risk-free rate in any currency if you can estimate an expected inflation rate, for which you might use as a proxy last year's inflation, unofficial inflation, your gut instinct about inflation, and add a real interest rate. Okay. I'll send you a blog post I sent out in July on currency risk-free rates, where I actually have inflation rates in, I think, 123 countries. So if you want to use it, it comes from the World Bank. So if you want to build up to risk-free rate, it actually is a way of building up to risk-free rates. So let's say I was able to do all of this, and I've come up with risk-free rates. So these are not government bond rates. I've cleaned up the government bond rates. I've come up with risk-free rates in different currencies. I've kind of given away the answer. But let's see if you can affirm it for me. Why are risk-free rates different in different currencies? Don't think too long. They're risk-free, so it can't be risky country, safe country. Why are they different? differences in inflation. And once you say that, you've essentially cracked. Remember we talked about cracking the code? That's the code for currency. So once you recognize that, then you're going to see why currency doesn't matter in valuation. You say, what do you mean currency doesn't matter? If you value a company in, let's say, Nigerian Naira, is your discount rate going to be really high? Yeah, your risk-free rate is 10% plus. Your discount rate is going to be 18, 20, 23. So if you pick one of those high risk-free rate currencies, your discount rate is, you think, this is terrible. But when you do your cash flows, we talked about consistency, right? So if your discount rate is Naira, your cash flows also have to be Naira. So when you do your cash flows, that inflation which bedeviled you in the discount rate is now going to be helping you pushing up your cash flows. Later in this class, I'm going to actually value a company first in rupees, and then I'm going to value it in US dollars at the same point in time. And if I do my job right, I should get exactly the same value for the company because inflation washes out. You can't make a company become a good or a bad company just by switching currencies. And that's what, I mean, for a long time in Latin America, I'd run into analysts and, you know, I'd ask them about a company and there'd be no country risk in the analysis. And so what happened? I've dollarized the cash flows. So what? They just converted the cash flows to dollars. So that makes the country risk go away. The company's still in Brazil. It still has all its operations exposed to risk. So converting currencies is like converting temperatures. And it's just as absurd to compare rates in different currencies as it is to compare different temperatures. You know what I mean by different? You leave Frankfurt Airport on a flight to New York. You check your the temperature. The local, not your temperature. I know that would be kind of freaky. You check the temperature. It says 32 degrees Celsius, right? You land in New York. You check the temperature. It says 86 degrees. You freak out. Oh, my God. I've landed on Mars. Well, you left Celsius, you got to Fahrenheit, you got to change your frame of reference. It's the same thing. When you move across currencies, that's why you can have a rate that looks high, but it's really not that high. And a rate that looks low, but it's really not that low. You've got to control for what currency you're working with. One final test about risk-free rates. And this is, I think, the core of what that last blog post was. I mean, one of the recurring issues that analysts have faced in the last 5-6 years is that risk-free rates seem low relative to normal numbers. Now, I'll tell you something. You know what normal is defined by? Often when I go to investment banks and somebody says that, I ask them, how old are you? So what do you need to know? Because I'll tell you what your normal risk-free rate is. If you're in your 60s, normal is about 6% for you. If you're in your 40s, normal is about 4.5%. If you're in your 20s, normal is 2.5%. Our frame of reference is often defined by when we entered the markets. So normal is kind of a fuzzy word. But there's this view, today's rates are too low. And when you say something is too low, you feel the urge to fix it, right? In fact, about half of all discounted cash flow valuations I see right now in US dollars try to fix it. What do? They replace the current 10-year T-bond rate, which is 2.2%, with a normal number, 4, 5. They say, well, I'm just normalizing. My advice to you is don't go there. And here's why. Let's suppose I replace today's T-bond rate with a 5% T-bond rate. What's going to happen to my discount rates? They're going to get pushed up. What's going to happen to my value? It's going to get pushed down. You're going to find stocks are overpriced, and then you're going to put your money in the 5% bond that exists only in your mind. A T-bond rate is not some estimation number. It's an opportunity cost today, whether you like it or I like it. Today, if I don't buy stocks, guess where I have to invest my money? At that T-bond that delivers that super low 2.2%, not a normal number. Don't normalize risk-free rates. You have to be consistent, and if the counter that somebody says is, then how do you explain low risk-free rates? Don't say the Fed did it with QE in the library. And that's my clue. Now, if you ever played Clue, you know, it's always, this is a question to which the Fed is always the reason. The Fed did it, the Fed did it. No, the Fed didn't do it. Remember I said the interest rate is a sum of two numbers, expected inflation and real interest rates. So here's what I did in this graph. I took the inflation rate in each year, and the GDP growth. So those are the columns. So if you look at the gray plus purple, that is each year added. And then I superimpose the 10-year T-bond rate on top of that. And what do you see? Looks like the two move together. In fact, here's what I see. Maybe you don't see the same thing. What's been true about GDP growth and inflation for the last 5 years? There's been no inflation and growth has been abysmal. No plus abysmal is low. With or without the Fed? So if you look at the last 5 years, it's true rates have been low, but they would have been low with the Fed or without the Fed. There's a Fed effect, but it, at least based on my estimate, the Fed effect is about 30 to 35 basis points. It's not 3%. Don't give the Fed powers it really doesn't have. I mean, I used the, I'll close with this, and I did the Fed post. I read the story of Chanticleer. It's a story that's been around since Chaucer, I think, 1400s. It's about this rooster that crows every morning. And the sun comes up. And all the barnyard animals think the rooster is doing it. And the rooster is the king of the barnyard. He makes the sun come up. And if he's not there, the sun will not come up. Then one day something bad happens to the rooster. He oversleeps or something. His alarm doesn't go off. The sun comes up anyway. Overnight, the rooster loses his power. You say, what's this got to do to the Fed? We've attached the power. The Fed sets interest rates. The Fed set, you know, in fact, the biggest thing the Fed should be afraid of is on September 17th, the Federal Open Market Committee meets and decides to change interest rate policy. Monumental, right? You know what the Fed should be afraid of? That the next day, nothing happens. Here's the other thing the Fed has to be afraid of. They do nothing and the rates go up anyway because growth goes up. So in a sense, that's really what you should be watching for next week is will the sun come up even if the rooster is not crowing? And we'll see what happens. So I'll see you next Monday.
Thank you. their effect is strongest in really short intervals, which is 10-day, 5-day, which none of us really see in our credit card loans, in our bank loans, and more. People might be affected by the banks and bank reserves, and the Fed can affect that.
There's a short-term effect a lot.
There is a short-term effect, but only to the extent that it's coming down. So, right? So if you're raising short-term rates because you see inflation coming back, the market says, oh my God, they must see signs of inflation, so the long-term rate goes up.